This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at civilpodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at civilpodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. Can the United States police the world? Can we identify and act on another country's national security interests? These are some of the issues addressed by Donald Nectarlion at this month's meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. Donald E. Nectarlion grew up in Saginaw, Michigan, and received his undergraduate and Ph.D. degrees in political science from the University of Michigan. He served on active duty in the Navy during World War II and was commissioned in 1945. After the war ended, he served in the U.S. military occupation of Germany in Bremerhaven and Berlin. Mr. Nectarlion had a long career in federal government, at home and abroad. After joining the State Department in 1952, he served in Washington, D.C., and at the U.S. embassies in Reykjavik, Iceland, and Bangkok, Thailand. In 1965, he joined the Senior Staff, International Security Affairs, in the Office of the Secretary of Defense as a specialist on Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War. In 1968, he became a founding faculty member of the Federal Executive Institute in Charlottesville and lectured and conducted seminars on U.S. foreign policy. He retired from government service in 1988. Mr. Nectarlion spoke at the March 9, 2011 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member Sue Liberman.
I don't want to miss anything in introducing our speaker today, so forgive me, I'm going to read what I have written. We're really quite honored to have Don Nectarlion here. Don actually grew up in Saginaw, Michigan, and received his undergraduate and doctorate degree in political science from the University of Michigan. He served on active duty in the Navy during World War II and was commissioned in 1945. After the end of the war, he served with the U.S. military in the occupation of Germany in two different cities, including Berlin. Don has a long career in federal government, at home and abroad. After joining the State Department in 1952, he served in Washington, D.C., and at the U.S. embassies in Ireland and Thailand. In 1965, he joined the Senior Staff, International Security Affairs, in the Office of the Secretary of Defense as a specialist on Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War. In 1968, he became the founding faculty member of the Federal Executive Institute here in Charlottesville, and lectured and conducted seminars on U.S. foreign policy there. He retired from government service in 1988. Dr. Nectarlion has taught U.S. foreign policy in both the United States and abroad, including George Washington University in D.C., Queen's University in Canada, and I can't pronounce the university in Germany. Maybe, Don, you can do that for me. He was a Rockefeller Fellow at the University of California at Berkeley, a Fulbright Scholar at the University College of Wales, visiting faculty member at St. Anthony's College in Oxford, England, and a Research Fellow at the Australian National University. During each of these fellowships, he's written a book on various aspects of U.S. foreign policy. As a matter of fact, he's the author of 10 books, the most recent, Defiant Superpower, The New American Hegemony. Did I say that right? Thank you. He writes a monthly commentary on international relations currently for several Virginia papers, including Charlottesville, Richmond, Lynchburg, and Roanoke. Don and his wife, Mildred, who is here today, have 4 children and 6 grandchildren, and they reside in Albemarle County, right near Charlottesville. Let's give a very warm welcome to Don Nectarlion. Thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure to see so many people here today. They say it's going to rain before this afternoon is out, so I hope it doesn't affect our departure. It certainly won't affect us while we're here. Well, the subject that Sue called me about a few weeks ago, I don't think even she realized how dramatic things would be this week in the Middle East. I think at that time we were having demonstrations in Egypt, and look what's happened just in the last 3 weeks to the Middle East. So the subject, I think, is a very appropriate one. U.S. national interests and policies for the United States in the Middle East. I'd like to start out by making a couple of comments in general. In my view, and I say this to my students, I've also taught at UVA, off and on over the last 30 years, they keep inviting me to come back. I say this to audiences and especially to students. It's not enough to discuss U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East without first defining U.S. national interests there, the national interests which guide our policies. So what I'd like to do this morning or this afternoon is to give you a little framework in which to help you define what you think United States interests are in the Middle East, and then we'll go into the question of how should policies be formulated. This is especially true in the kind of issues that we faced in Libya. A very, very controversial subject right now. And one of my friends, Rotary friends, reminded me when he came in, did I see the George Will column this morning in the Washington Post? It's here. I strongly recommend that you read it because this is what I consider a dose of realism. There's been a lot of stuff written in the last 2 or 3 weeks that simply don't address the question of costs. And I think that's what George Will is talking about when he talks about no-fly zones and all these other things in Libya. Now, the National Interest Matrix, which we've passed out, I published this in 3 or 4 of my books, and those of you who take my Jill class, or now Ollie classes, how many of you here have been in my Ollie or Jill classes? Okay, well, you've been through this, then. You know what the National Interest Matrix is all about. Anyway, I'm going to give you just a sample of it today because I think it helps you put in perspective what it is that we're trying to do, what we're trying to see in the Middle East. What is it that we'd like to see come out of all of this? It's a framework for policymakers and concerned citizens like yourselves to think through what you believe, not what the president or the secretary of state, but what do you believe are the most important things that we have at stake in this volatile area. The first task we have is to consider four basic national interests. Now, you can see them on the matrix. Those are the four on the vertical scale. And let me discuss these very briefly, and because it opens up the way for our discussion. The defense of homeland. Now, these definitions are very precise because I'd like you to think the differences how we approach each one when we come to making policy. Defense of homeland is the protection of U.S. territory, U.S. citizens, and our constitutional system. Now, that's very narrow. We're talking about the defense of this country, our 50 states. Normally, I include Canada in this and also the Caribbean because that's part of our defense has to do with our adjacent neighbors. But that's a very narrow way of looking at it. Our territory, our citizens, and our constitutional system. The second one is economic well-being. This has to do with enhancing our citizens' opportunities and our standard of living as a nation. The economic well-being of the United States is a basic national interest of the United States. The third one is a creation, as I would say, of a favorable world order, or maintenance of a favorable world order. What does this mean? It means to build a secure world with stable governments and hopefully democratic governments. That's the kind of world we would like to see out there, outside North America, if you will, because this is different from the defense of the homeland. This has to do with creating the kind of world that we feel safe in living in, and where our trade, our commerce, and business can thrive, where people can travel easily without fear of being apprehended. That's what we'd like to see as a favorable world order. And finally, the promotion of U.S. values abroad. Now, this is a sticky one. I have to tell you that classical scholars like Hans Morgenthau and Henry Kissinger and the old group that dealt with U.S. foreign policy tended to dismiss this. Their view was, Kissinger's come around to a different view in his more mature years, but their classic view was that we paid attention to another country's foreign policy. It wasn't that we didn't care, we didn't put the same kind of emphasis on how that state treated its own people. And I've argued for 40 years in my scholarship that for the United States, that definition is not good enough. Since the founding of the United States, we have always been interested in democracy, freedom of the individual, individual rights, the rule of law, and all these things that we Americans take for granted. A lot of countries, as you know, don't. And the question here is, to what extent should that be a fundamental, basic interest of the United States to promote those values abroad? Now, looking at the horizontal part of your matrix, we then come to the question of what is the intensity? The intensity of threats to these basic national interests. And here I've listed them. Let me define them briefly. A survival interest is where a critical threat to the homeland exists. A critical, you could add the word imminent, threat to the homeland. That hasn't happened very much to the United States. Up until the Second World War, we were pretty well blessed with two oceans and friendly countries to the north and south. We never had to worry about a threat to the homeland. Then we were hit by Pearl Harbor. Now, that was in Hawaii. Hawaii was a territory at the time, not even a state. But we considered it part of the United States, and we went to war over that. When we discuss defense of homeland in those terms, there are only a few other examples. I would say the Cuban Missile Crisis came fairly close to it, but it wasn't there yet. Scholars have argued about that for a long time. In any case, the point I want to make is that survival is something where you have very little time. A president has very little time to decide what to do. Now, if you studied your European history, you'll know that's precisely what happened in the outbreak of both the First and the Second World Wars. Germany was pushing, and they issued ultimatums, and either you gave up or you suffered the consequences. That's what I call a survival interest to the state. We really haven't had that kind of a threat. Now, the more useful. I shouldn't say useful is not the right word, but the more common threat that we have, that presidents and their national security councils have to worry about, are what we call, what I call, vital interest, vital level intensities. Let me define that one. This is a dangerous challenge to the United States, and it's one that cannot be negotiated further. These are the kinds of issues where you hope you can sit down at the bargaining table and work out with an adversary some kind of a deal that you can avoid war. But sometimes you can't do that. And sometimes a president has to decide, okay, we've negotiated this far enough, we've got to be more serious and try to convince the other side that we can't go any further. One of my students once said, this is the difference between going to the mat and going to the table. And that's not a bad characterization. You simply decide after a while that you simply can't talk about it anymore. The other side will not give, and you decide for whatever reason you cannot give up anymore. When you've crossed that line, and I usually draw a very black line. Is there one on this one? Yeah. When you cross that black line from major into a vital interest, you are in effect saying, I have to be prepared to use much tougher measures to avoid the consequences. Now, major interests are where the issue is serious, but not dangerous. Dangerous has to do with vital interests. They're serious, but you can probably negotiate them, even though the result might be somewhat painful. Okay? Now, the final one is peripheral interests, and those have to do with private companies, non-government organizations, church groups, missionaries, aid groups, private groups that are operating abroad. Now, some of them have problems, and they go to our embassies to get help. Those are peripheral because they don't affect the overall interests of the United States, even though they may affect the company or the organization rather severely. But the State Department tries to keep things at that level for a variety of reasons. But occasionally they get bumped up into the major interest, particularly if it's an issue having to do with a big American company that's operating overseas and has its property confiscated, as occurred in Cuba when Castro took over, and is happening more often in Venezuela than we would like. But that's when private interests begin to become a more important national interest. Now, moving on to the next page. Before I go on, let me see if there are any questions on this particular part of the matrix. This is all kind of conceptual, and I don't want to bore you with a lot of extra time on it. But I'll be glad to come back and discuss this with you in a bit. Okay, turn to the second page where we're talking about how you define a vital interest. I've listed there eight cost value factors and eight cost risk factors. And the problem here is that oftentimes policymakers, and this is true in the Pentagon and in the State Department, both of which I've served, and other government agencies, they put a lot of value on the values, the objectives, the good things that we like to accomplish. But unfortunately, in my research and writing, I found that policymakers often, too often, don't put enough emphasis on the question of costs and the risks. And so what I've done here, and I won't spend a lot of time on it, is list 8 value factors that I think are discussed in the National Security Council and in the various agencies, and 8 cost-risk factors. Now, I should tell you that I developed that list, and it's been modified since, but I developed that list primarily after my experience in the Pentagon having to do with the Vietnam War. As you know, Sue mentioned that I came here in 1968 to help establish the Federal Executive Institute. I had just come out of a 3-year experience of working on Southeast Asia in the Office of the Secretary of Defense and watching what happened to our policy, to our country, as a result of the mistakes that were made in the Vietnam War. And so I wanted to write something that would help people like us here today to get a handle on the question of how do you avoid these things? How do you avoid the mistakes that we made in Vietnam? Now, I have to tell you, I'm not like John Kerry. I use his name. I'm not one of those who said it was a terrible error. We never should have been bothered with it at all. It was, you know, I'm not a peacenik. But my point here is to say that the United States had to develop a better way of deciding, before it went to war, what the costs and the risks would be. So these factors that I've come up with are the result of that experience, plus trying it out on seminars at the Federal Executive Institute and a couple of universities and people like you, just over the years of trying to get a handle on this question of what it is that we Americans think we want to do and we don't pay enough attention to the cost. And I have a column that I think is coming out on Sunday that addresses that question around Libya. The State Department, by and large, going back to the matrix, the State Department, by and large, likes to keep things to the right-hand side of that line. In the major interest, and peripheral to some extent, you're trained as a diplomat. And, you know, I served in the State Department for almost 10 years. These are very, very bright people. They're honorable people. They wouldn't be in government unless they had something more to offer than just making money. So let's start with that. These are people that are very well-educated, they're well-trained, and they look at the world in a way that says, how can we arrange our relations with other countries to avoid any issue becoming so critical that we're going to have to use force? That's the name of the game for a diplomat, is to negotiate and not fight. Now, I spent 4 years over in the Pentagon, my first in the Navy as a civilian, working in the Chief of Naval Operations Office, and then I was hired up in McNamara's office in the Office of the Secretary to work on Southeast Asia. Why? Because my wife and I had just come back from 3 years in Thailand, and I was in Berkeley for a year to write a book about that experience. And so they said, Nectarline, come and work for us and see what you can do to help us think through what we're doing there. And that was an experience. And what I learned was, again, very bright, dedicated public servants, both military and civilians, working at this level. But their view of the world is that it's nasty out there. There are really bad guys out there. And if you're not careful, they're going to do you in. And we have to be prepared with enough power and enough training that we can deal with these crises when the White House decides that it isn't a major interest any longer. It's crossed the line, to use my conceptual framework here. So this is the struggle at the White House, whether it's on Egypt or Libya or Iraq, Afghanistan. It's before they take military action, what are the interests at stake here? How deeply is it the U.S. involved, and what price are we willing to pay? And that's what you read the news, read the newspaper, listen to, watch the television. That's what the debate is all about. And these are powerful people that are sitting in the National Security Council. I've studied the National Security Council for quite a while and wrote a chapter in a book some years ago as to how it operates. It's fascinating. And you may not agree with everything that George Bush did in his presidency, but I recommend that you read his memoir, which is a very interesting read. It reads very well. It's a bit self-serving, but the insights that he gives you into how decisions were made, how the National Security Council operated, are very, very interesting. I haven't read Donald Rumsfeld's book yet. He's not one of my favorite Secretaries of Defense, but, you know, the reviews that I've read say that there is a lot of interesting insights into how the system operated or didn't operate properly. Bob Woodward's book on how Barack Obama decided policy on Afghanistan is fascinating. Some of you have read that. I recommend it because it doesn't matter whether you're for or against this president or the last president, and I'm a nonpartisan guy myself. I think that to study how decisions are made at this level around critical issues that can get American boys killed and can cost this country hundreds of billions of dollars to prosecute these wars, that's something that every citizen, senior statesman like you have here, Stu, these are things that you ought to be not only interested in, but determined that you're going to understand it and maybe influence other people, maybe your congressman. Okay, now I'd like to have a little discussion here, if you're interested, before we go on anything that I've said up to now. Where's Bill? Bill, is it okay that we can have a short discussion here? Okay.
So how come so many smart people allow so many young men and so much money to be spent on things like Vietnam, Iraq, and from what I've read now, the reasons that a lot of things happened on Iraq was because we had a president and a vice president, especially the vice president, whose history went back to wanting to...
Could I ask you to state your question?
The question is, how did so many smart people who are supposed to be watching over this allow a president and a vice president to get away?
All right, I got it. Smart people make mistakes. Okay? I mean, we're all smart people. Don't we make some mistakes once in a while? The real answer here is that we live in a democracy. We don't live in a dictatorship. And our leaders are influenced by a lot of people and by pressure groups. And pressure groups do have an influence. If you don't believe that, just look around at some of the things that influence congresspeople. So, they're smart people. But I think my honest answer here would be that they didn't realize when I got into these things what it was going to cost. I can say that for sure about Vietnam, because I was there on the decision-making. And McNamara said the war would be over by Christmas. Okay. Yes.
Okay. In your list of basic national interests, it seems that there is something missing that underlies actually the first two that you list, and that is energy sufficiency. I didn't say self-sufficiency because we're not self-sufficient anymore, but nevertheless, sufficiency to have energy coming from sources that we can depend on underlies those first two and is, I think, a very critical one.
Well, wouldn't you include energy supplies as part of the economic well-being interest?
But certainly it also fits with the first, because that's one of the ways that we defeated Hitler, for instance, by bombing the oil fields at Ploesti. So it involves defense of the homeland.
Oh, yeah, but you're talking there about when we were actually at war. I'm talking about peacetime. Once you've decided to go to war, then a lot of these things become part of the defense of homeland interest. But I think our energy supplies right now and the rising cost of oil, that's essentially an economic well-being interest, but it also laps over into the third one, for a favorable world order, because the reason we're having the energy spike is because there's very little world order right now in that part of North Africa, right? Okay. Anything else?
My question is similar to Shirley's. Are you saying that George Bush and his cohorts did not take these factors into account at all?
And second, no, I'm not saying that.
Oh.
Definitely not saying
they
that.
They did? They did? Look at lists like this and still made those decisions.
Oh, okay, I see. No, I didn't take this up to the White House and put it in front of George Bush's face, no. But I do know there are people in government who know about this system of mine, and at the lower level, they do. And so whether they talk about this or some other aspect of it, they are seized with the question of what do we want to accomplish and what are the costs. My point here is not that they don't look at the costs. They don't realize when they get into something that the costs are going to be much higher than they expected. And human nature being what it is, it's hard to quantify that. It's hard to tell in advance exactly what your costs are going to be.
The second part is today.
Well, maybe
today. Are they considering these things when they're talking about flying over Libya and all?
Okay, we're going to come to that. I promise you, we'll definitely come to Libya before this afternoon's out. Okay, one more, and then we'll move on.
In Libya today, you have a group of unarmed, basically unarmed people fighting for something that I think most of us here believe is a good cause. There are probably a great many people in institutions, countries very much like Libya, who are standing by and waiting to see what happens, who would be interested in fighting for that cause if they thought they had a chance and if they thought they had the support of a country like the United States. And yet we back off. Now we talk about losing lives. These people lose lives.
Okay, could I ask you,
the question is, why do we not show more support for such a situation?
Okay, we're going to come to that. My shorter answer is because the costs are extremely high. But we'll come back. Okay, moving on. Now, I'm going to suggest to you that policymakers have often given greater weight to the value factors than to the cost risk. And let me cite five cases. I mean, we're all old enough here to remember these. The first one is the Vietnam War, 1965, when Lyndon Johnson had to decide whether to escalate or begin to pull out. I had just entered the office of the Secretary of Defense, that part that's called the little State Department, in the Defense Department's office. And he made the decision in July of 1965 to escalate with up to 200,000 additional troops. We had about 25 or 30,000 there at the time. It was a huge increase. And that set the stage for everything else that happened in Vietnam. The second case is sending peacekeeping troops to Lebanon in 1982. Remember when Ronald Reagan wanted to stop the bloodshed in Beirut? And so he sent, I've forgotten how many Marines, must have been certainly several thousand Marines there, to try to separate the Israelis and the PLO that were fighting in the streets of Beirut. What happened? Well, they got themselves involved in a civil war. And when 241 Marines were killed in the barracks, remember, the American people said, for God's sake, what are we doing there? Pull them out. And he had to do it. And I thought at the time that that was going to ruin his chances for re-election. Well, you know, he pulled them out in time, and people went on to something else. If he had kept them there, I think he probably might not have been reelected. A little bit of how domestic politics influences foreign policy. A third one is the humanitarian intervention in Somalia. Do we all remember when George Bush, he had not been reelected? So it was in the transition between the time that he left and Bill Clinton took over. He looked at the television pictures coming out of Somalia of all those starving people out in the countryside that were not getting the food that had been sent in by humanitarian groups all over the world. Why? Because the shipments were being hijacked by these thugs riding around in trucks with machine guns. And so he decided for humanitarian reasons to send troops over there to see that the people were fed. And what happened? How many of you have seen or read the book Black Hawk Down? When those people got killed, the American people said, why are we there? Why are we there? So it goes to the question, yes, it was a nice thing to do, a humanitarian thing to do to feed these people. But when 17 or 18 of them got killed by thugs in Mogadishu, the American public said, it's not worth it. Essentially, they said, it's not worth it. And then there was the intervention in Kosovo. Remember, Bill Clinton decided that Kosovo, those poor people that were fighting those bad Serbs, deserved their independence. So he issued an ultimatum to Milosevic. Stop your ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. Get out and let these people decide their future. Good old American values, right? They have a right to self-determination. And what happened? Milosevic said, no way, and he kept on doing what he did in Kosovo. So Clinton, along with NATO, but it was mostly American forces, we launched airstrikes all over Serbia. It ruined parts of Belgrade, for example, took out all the bridges across the Danube, and for 77 or 78 days, we bombed them. Now, why did none of our pilots get shot down? Because they were flying over 15,000 feet. George Will mentions that in his article today. It was relatively casualty free, but the damage that was inflicted on Serbia was enormous. And finally, Milosevic gave up in that case. But we were being prepared, at least the U.S. NATO commander at the time, was urging the president to think about putting ground forces in there to stop this. And fortunately, the war ended before that was necessary. And finally, the Iraq War, and I don't have to go into that. The decision to go into Iraq is going to be debated for a long time, and I don't think Bush nor Rumsfeld or any of these people had any idea what they were getting into. There were people in CIA who knew. There were people in CIA who knew what was going to happen, and they were just ignored. Okay. U.S. interests in the Middle East. Let me say a few words about the history of the Middle East. Now, let me say this to you folks. I'm not an expert on the Middle East. Please don't question me on details of how each country is organized and so forth. Get Rui Ramazani or some of the experts at the university come to talk to you about the countries of the Middle East. My interest is U.S. policy. How do we Americans make up our minds whether it's important enough for us to get involved in things around the world, particularly when they're going to cost American lives and American treasure, as I call it? So until 1948, many people don't realize this. People our age probably do, but youngsters have no idea about this. My students at the university, and I was teaching there a couple years ago, they had no idea of what this period of history was. And when I found out how ill, this is a sidelight, so, I was really surprised, and I've said this to other people too, and including my colleagues at the university politics department. I was surprised at how poorly these kids, these are third and fourth year students, how poorly prepared they are in American history. I tried to find out why. Oh, well, most of them had taken, in high school, advanced placement or something. So they didn't have to take any history, any American history in college. And it showed. So for the first two or three weeks, I loaded them down with three or four or five books and made them read it and gave them a quiz at the end of it to be sure that they understood, you know, what had happened in the 19th century, for example, and why did we have the kinds of conflicts that we did even then with foreign countries? Okay, so in 1948, the United States had only a peripheral interest in the Middle East, using my terminology here, a peripheral interest in the Middle East. Why? Well, because Britain was the top power out there. Great Britain was the principal power in Egypt. It controlled the Suez Canal. In fact, it owned the Suez Canal. It was the primary power in Palestine. This is before Israel was formed. Palestine was a mandate that was given to Britain after the First World War. They were the top dogs, to use that term, in the Persian Gulf. They had their oil interests were heavily involved in both Iran and Iraq. So we didn't need to be involved. Our national interests in that part of the world, we're sort of, we'll rely on the British to take care of it. And what happened? In 1947, the British decided they were pulling out. They'd had enough. They got involved with the with a warfare in Palestine. The Jews from Israel were coming over and wanted to create their own state, and so they were fighting against the British as well as the Palestinians. And so it was costing too much. And as you know, the British had gone almost bankrupt during the Second World War. And after the war, the Labor government simply decided they could not be a world power. So they began pulling back from all kinds of places, and this was the one that we had to decide whether or not we would replace them. Truman decided that we would become, in a way, the guarantor of peace in the Middle East at that time. Israel had just declared its independence in 1948. The UN had gone along with it, and Truman decided that we would recognize this state. I don't think Truman at the time realized what turmoil this was going to cause to our relations with the rest of the Middle East. Nevertheless, it happened. And our policy changed because it was also in 1948 that the Cold War began in Europe. Remember? The Berlin airlift. The blockade, and then the airlift began in the spring of 1948. And that was the beginning of the Cold War. So here's Harry Truman, faced with the British pulling out of the Middle East, the Russians planning to take advantage of that, and he decides that we had really no choice but to take an interest in that part of the world. Now, we didn't send troops, but we, in effect, used our enormous economic power at the end of the Second World War to begin to influence events there. So that set the stage for a whole new period of U.S. involvement. And my argument is that we probably had no choice. We probably had no choice around that because if we didn't do it, who would? And this is where the third category of the matrix becomes very important, world order interests. To what extent is it an interest of the United States to be the leader of the, quote, free world at a time when we were the country after the Second World War that had most of the world's production? We were the richest country by far in the world. We had the most powerful military, although we began to decimate it right after the war. Truman began to rebuild it when the Cold War started. And the question then is, who's going to do it if America doesn't? And since the Soviet Union was then rising as the power in Central Asia and wanted to be the power in the Middle East, what would happen if the United States decided not to do it? If we had done what the country did after the First World War of simply saying, we don't care what happens to the rest of the world as long as we can trade. And I think wisely, the Truman and successor presidents decided that was something that we couldn't afford as a country to ignore, that our own defense of homeland interest would ultimately be threatened if we didn't show, quote, leadership in the rest of the world. Now, the question for us today in the Middle East is how important are the countries of that area, and when I say the Middle East and North Africa, I'm really starting with Iran, the Persian Gulf, the Arab countries, and the North African littoral, which are Arab countries, even though they're in Africa. It extends in a way, although it's a bit of a stretch, from Iran to Morocco. And if you look at your maps in the newspapers, you'll see that they try to cover all of that, and they have different shadings for how bad things are at the time. I would ask us to think about four questions. To what extent is the defense of the homeland, the U.S. homeland, affected? Does any country in the Middle East threaten the security of North America? That's the first question. Does anything out there affect the defense and the security of North America? Second question, how greatly is the economic well-being of the United States impacted by the events in the region, and for what reasons? Third question, to what extent is the peace of the Middle East a concern of the United States, and which countries in that area have the highest interest for this country? And finally, and this goes to the point that the gentleman back here raised, how important is promotion of freedom and democracy, the rule of law, and fair elections in this area to the United States? Now, I'm going to give you an exercise here that you can do in place, but pick up your matrix, because I'm going to give you something to do. Using the matrix which is in front of you, place these six countries, write them down, in the boxes that you think they should go. Okay? I do this with my students, so don't feel that I'm putting you on here. It's an interesting exercise, because what it does is force you to think for yourself. How important is this to me? Okay? The first one is Egypt. Where would you put Egypt in those boxes? There'd be four boxes for each country. Okay, Egypt is the first one. Where would you put Egypt on the matrix? Four boxes.
Actually, I would ask myself, which country has oil? All the countries that have oil, I would put in all categories that you have listed here. Because we have really, in the Middle East, in Africa, only involved ourselves in countries that have oil.
Okay. It's an interesting point. I guess I would answer it briefly by saying, does the United States, do we drivers of our cars, have to have oil from the Middle East? We probably, I mean, for our defense of homeland. For economic reasons, yeah, but for defense of homeland, that's the reason that I would question a little bit about putting it in that box under defense. Okay, now let's move on to Saudi Arabia. How many of you had Saudi Arabia as a vital interest under any of these? Okay, yeah. Okay, and I assume the reason is oil. Does anybody have a different reason for having? Yes? Oh, you'd put it on in critical.
Yes.
Well, could I ask you, does that fit the category of an imminent threat of massive destruction on your own homeland? No.
I suppose not.
Painful, but not disastrous.
But you're right.
Okay. Yes? Okay.
Saudi Arabia also supports a lot of the terrorist organization. They're a very rich country, and they do support the terrorist organizations. And so...
Okay. So you'd put them vital at what level?
Absolutely.
Where? Now, which
I would put them in every one of them.
All of them?
Yes.
Okay.
And they're in bed with our State Department, so they're dangerous.
Okay. Yes, here's a... Wait for the mic.
Oh, I do? I don't suppose it really makes a difference, but some years ago I had contact with the Saudi Arabians. They were some of the finest people I ever met. Now, this was a man in Washington that was on the top man, and it appears that I was working in interior design at the time, so they called me to come to do their house. They were absolutely magnificent people, but when things turned around, I still felt that those people, of course, they weren't just ordinary people, but okay. I was very pleased with them.
Oh, all right, fine. Let me ask the group, how many of you have actually traveled in the Middle East? Let's see your hands. Okay, so some of you have some personal experience. I know one of your members here has a son that lives in Beirut, or a family living in Beirut, and so you get out there regularly, don't you? Oh, you are, going back. Yeah, some of you probably know a lot more about the area than I do and about the rest of us. So if you want to tell us a little bit about it in the question period, well, we'll certainly accommodate that. Okay, let's move on then to Iraq. How many of you would put that in the vital category? I certainly would. Why? Because we're there. If you had asked me that 10 years ago, I would have perhaps had a different answer. And Israel, how many of you would put Israel in the vital category? Okay, quite a few of us would. Because we have a historic humanitarian interest in Israel. Well, okay. It's during the Cold War, it was definitely a strategic interest of ours, definitely strategic because of its military capability. After the Cold War, it became more questionable. But yes, ma'am.
I put Israel in the critical category because they are our only proven friend in the Middle East, and also they provide a lot of technical help, intelligence help, and also business for the U.S. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess I would have to ask you, is it an imminent threat to the United States? I mean, is it in the same category as the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example? But I think when you say critical, you're raising it to a level that I think most Americans would not agree with. Vital, yes, but critical? That's a very narrow definition, and it means it's a sudden threat to your homeland, a sudden immense threat to the homeland. Yes, ma'am. Here.
It could be critical to us in another way if they decided to use their nuclear power against anyone else in the Middle East.
Who?
We're talking about Israel.
Yeah, but if you said it's.
If they decide to use their nuclear power against any of their neighbors.
Oh, the Israelis would use their nuclear weapons. Yeah, that would not be critical to the defense of homeland, but it would be critical to world order. I'd put it at that level under the fourth category, or the third category of world order. Because that will trigger a major war all over the Middle East, if that ever happened. And thank God it hasn't happened so far. Yes?
I guess I'm having a problem with the distinction between vital and critical with respects to threats.
Yeah.
By contrast to some of the comments which relate to our strategic interest, which mm-hmm. relates to those people who are not threats but who are colleagues in the world order. And mm-hmm. that's why I guess I wouldn't put Israel in a vital, dangerous position. But although Israel is certainly in our strategic interests, as mm-hmm. is Saudi Arabia and a number of the other countries that were mentioned.
So you would not put it in the critical. You wouldn't put it even in the vital category. Okay. Now let me say, normally we consider countries that are allies of the United States, which means that the Senate has stated that we're part of an alliance. That would apply to NATO, all the NATO countries, and it would apply to countries like Japan and Australia, New Zealand, obviously Canada is a member of NATO. It probably applies certainly to the countries to the south of us. But the question then, those are vital interests without question. If you're an ally of the United States, and an attack on any of them, according to the NATO doctrine, is an attack on everybody. And that would involve us in war. That's what the Cold War was all about. If the Soviets had attacked any of those countries, they knew they'd be at war with us. Question is whether Israel fits that category. They're clearly an ally, but they are in a different category from the NATO countries. I happen to think that Israel is a vital interest under the fourth category, the promotion of values. For what the lady here said, it's one of the few countries in the Middle East that's democratic. I think you could say now that certainly Turkey is democratic. Iraq is becoming democratic with our help and sacrifice. And hopefully Egypt will be a democracy once they get through this turmoil they're in. But I would certainly put Israel in that category. Okay, finally, Libya. Now we're coming to what this seminar is all about. How many of you have Libya as a vital interest of the United States under any category? Let's see your hands. You do. Okay. You want to give her the microphone?
Well, I don't want to tell you
why. Oh. Well, you have to be able to defend your position.
I put it under favorable world order, but I'm not sure I could give you a reason for that.
Okay, all right. Well, that's reasonable. What else? Well, let's address this then. Has Libya been a friend of the United States in the past? No. They shot down, remember, the Pan Am Flight 103. 250 American, mostly students, were killed in that. And they shot up some of our soldiers in Berlin. And Reagan sent bombers. Remember, in 1986. Reagan said this, enough is enough, and he sent bombers, and they bombed Tripoli and Gaddafi's own headquarters and Benghazi. He didn't invade. It's important to remember, Reagan was very careful about using ground troops, particularly after the Marines got shot up in Beirut. So he was very careful on how he used U.S. power. But Gaddafi has been... Libya has been no friend of the United States, but it's got oil. Not as much oil as Saudi Arabia has, but there's a good bit of oil there, and they could probably pump a lot more. Now, we don't get much of our oil from Libya, but the Europeans do. The Europeans definitely do, and that's why they have a higher interest in what's happening in Libya today than we do. Okay, how many of you think we have a promotion of values interest in Libya?
I think when it comes to human rights, you know, they are not in sync with our policy. So I think we have a vested interest in the promotion.
Okay, could I ask you at what level? Vital or major?
Not, I'd say major.
Okay.
Not vital.
Anybody else?
I agree with her 100% for the very same reasons, and the promotion of democracy.
Okay.
But major.
Okay. So would you put Libya in any box under vital?
No.
No. Okay. How about world order? Anybody put it or tempted to put it, yes, in the back?
This was the point that I had in mind when I first brought it up. I think the example that is set in Libya would be a pretty good billboard as to United States policy in other countries where democracy is making an attempt.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But where would you put it on the scale of interest, the intensity?
Major.
Okay, all right. Well, if I gather, what you're saying here is that there are certain countries in the Middle East that we definitely rate higher than others. Saudi Arabia, mostly because of oil. Egypt, because it's the biggest country and most influential of the Arab countries. Israel, because of our long association with a democratic state and the fact that it is a military power that can help us in many ways if we get into conflicts out there. And what else? That's about it, isn't it? Or we did mention Iraq, and that's because since we're there and we have expended over 4,000 lives and hundreds of billions of dollars of treasure, we do feel that we want to see this thing through and see that there is a democracy, a stable democracy that's going to be friendly to us instead of antagonistic to us. So I guess I would say staying the course in Iraq to see this thing through so that it doesn't relapse back into dictatorship probably is a vital interest. Yes.
When you said what else, you didn't mention Iran, and its actions can have an effect upon Israel. It's working on ballistic missiles.
Yeah. I didn't put Iran in this list because it's not an Arab country, number one. Number two, it's in a different category. For a variety of reasons, and you're right. That would be a defense of homeland interest of ours if they, in fact, I guess it would still be at the vital level if they have nuclear weapons, like Pakistan. Pakistan and India both have them. We wish that they didn't, but they did it anyway. So we have to live with it. The real question on Iran, and I'd prefer not to get into a discussion because that'll take all afternoon, is could we live with an Iran that has nuclear weapons, as we have lived with Pakistan, that we are having problems with? Could we live with that? That's a debate that's going on in Europe today. We don't hear much about it in this country because nobody wants to face that possible reality, that they will eventually get it. Then the question is, what do they do with them? Once you get nuclear weapons, what good are they? You say, well, you can threaten your neighbors if they don't behave. Well, so what? We're in Iraq. We're protecting Saudi Arabia's oil. We're trying to build a democracy in Egypt. So even if they did have a couple of nuclear weapons, what would it? That's the argument that's being used. Same way with North Korea. They got them, so what? They aren't able to get very much for it right now. Okay, we are open to 14 minutes of good rapid discussion. And you can ask questions or you can challenge me on anything you want to, but I would please ask you to be brief.
If Iran gains nuclear weapons, do you have any doubt that the Israelis will find a way, just as they did with the Sirac reactor 30 years ago in Iraq, to eliminate those facilities, which will become to my way of thinking, a vital interest to our country.
And what's your question?
I'm asking you, do you think that there's any doubt that the Israelis will find a way to destroy those facilities?
I have no idea what the Israelis would do. If you ask me about U.S. policy, I'd feel more comfortable. I guess my reading tells me, and what I've read that people out of the Pentagon say, the Israelis cannot do that without our help. The issue then is, to what extent could the Israelis persuade us to give them help to do that? And that is a question for U.S. foreign policy. Next question.
Going back a few years to the Iraq War, first Iraq War, when we went into Iraq, that sort of the undercurrent strategy idea was that we're going to get a foothold for democracy over there and then have sort of a domino effect.
Mm-hmm.
Would you call what's happening now all over the place that domino effect?
Good question.
People uprising.
So what has begun in Tunisia and gone to Egypt, you're saying, will that affect all the other countries? I think that's correct. I take your point. That's what George Bush and Condoleezza Rice argued a lot, that the idea of democracy and freedom, human freedom, is something that everybody wants, and if given a chance, they'll go for it. I'm not sure I can make that direct connection between Iraq and what's happened in Egypt. I think what happened in Egypt was a result of a lot of young Egyptians that decided they had had enough, and when Mubarak was up for re-election, you know, in this coming September. When Mubarak made signals that he wanted his son to replace him and to establish a kind of a dynasty, I think that was the signal. And what triggered it was what happened in Tunisia. And once it happened there, and nobody shot him up and killed them all, the Egyptians who were ready said, well, we'd like to make some changes. Yes.
My question is, can we force other countries to want a democracy? This is what has made every country to want a democracy,
to be in a democratic government.
The next thing is, do other countries mistrust us? We have nuclear weapons.
That mistrust us?
Mistrust
what?
Our country. I really don't know. And I am an American, of course, and I believe in America. But maybe they
That's a legitimate question. Do foreigners trust us? I think there are a lot of people in the Middle East who are not sure they want to trust us. I think that we don't hear enough about this in the American media. I don't know why they don't seem to want to touch it. But the fact of the matter is that what we did in Iraq has turned off people all over the Middle East, particularly young people. The polls seem to show this. The Pew Institute did a poll of a bunch of countries a few years ago, and I think I cite that in my last book. We have paid a very high price in terms of our image in the Middle East because of what happened in Iraq. Abu Ghraib was just more of the same there. So I think that's a good point. And that's one of the reasons that I give Obama credit today for being very cautious and careful and not being bellicose. He said, you know, we think the regime should change. We wish he'd leave. We want him to leave. But he has not said that we're going to do it. He said, you know, let other people see what they want to do, and I think that's a very good policy. Yes.
Don, he also made a 2009 Cairo speech, right? Do you think that was important or not? That's not my question. That's a prelude.
Yeah. Well, that set the stage. The question is, the Egyptians, you all of you know, the president made a major speech in Cairo in 2009 that got the Israelis very upset. But what began to open the eyes of Egyptians and Middle Easterners that maybe the mistakes that were made by Bush in Iraq could be corrected. That sort of set a new tone that Barack Obama gave in Cairo. And whether that had a direct effect on what happened this year, I'm not sure I could make that. But there certainly he set the stage for new thinking about what kind of governments these people want.
Thanks. Now my real question. As I look at your matrix, the column, defense of homeland, economic well-being, favorable world order, promotion of values. And I'm thinking of this in imagining what would a tactics matrix like this look like for some foreign policy people in one of the Western European countries that we admire, that have a per capita income more or less what we have. And I remember that the United States spends about half of the world's expenditures on defense. It spends twice as much per capita as those Western Europeans.
What's your question?
I'm getting to it. Anyway, so the point is that for many, many decades, we have assumed that we should naturally have a military force and capability to actually, you know, deal with all of these rows that you have mm-hmm. in your matrix. Do you think that's still the right approach for the United States, considering tough budget times?
Wow. What you're really asking is whether or not we can afford to be a superpower. And that's a good question. You know, people like us, senior citizens, who pay our taxes and try to do the right thing, worry about how the deficits and all that. And I mean, we all grew up in an age where you paid attention to budget deficits. You paid attention to not spending more than you could afford. And here we're looking at the government that's going on $14 trillion in national debt. Good question. Can we afford to be a world power? Yes, but yes, we can be a world power, but we don't need to be the world's policeman. And folks, there's a difference between those. You can have interests everywhere. You can encourage people here, and you can promote democracy. You can have economic aid. We should give a lot more economic aid. But we don't have to have bases all over the world, and we do. It's astonishing how many military installations we have all over the world. It's well over 100. Now, some of them are small, but we're building them all over Africa today. Why? Because we're worried about security in the African countries. And that's what drives American policy, is this fear, this security obsession almost that we have about anything that happens in any part of the world is going to be against us. And until we can break that habit of thinking that everything that happens is a threat, we're going to be stuck with where we are. I think gradually, because of the recession and the slowness of our recovery and 9% unemployment, which is going to last for a few more years, I think people are finally beginning to be realistic about our ability to sustain all of the commitments around the world that we have accumulated.
Where did this paranoia start?
Well, you use the word paranoid.
That's what it sounds like.
I'm not sure. I would say that it's paranoia. That's a different cat. You need a psychiatrist for that one. Yes.
We have time for one more question.
Okay.
And I will give it to our senior statesman.
I didn't know I was that old.
Charlie, if we're brief, we could get another one in after you.
Yeah, you and I are about the same age, so we qualify.
Yeah, we are.
Anyhow, the question I have is this. I commend you on the use of this matrix because it gives us a good vision of of how to evaluate these different countries in our own eyes. What it needs, though, I think, is a third dimension to it, and that is solutions. In other words, if we decide that we have this sort of situation with Libya, we're discussing solutions right now, the flyover, for example. Are we going to send in arms? Is there a way of getting in arms? Are we just going to send in food and help? What type of thing are we going to do?
But Charlie, that's not an interest. That's the implementation of an interest.
Exactly. And I think that needs to be a part of the matrix, though, as far as how you would implement this in the final analysis.
Okay. All right.
Anyhow, I commend you on your presentation, especially on your ability to bring out so much interest in this group with questions of their own to you.
Thank you, Charlie.
And I'd like to say in Charlie's behalf that I use the term senior statesman as a matter of importance and prestige, not age.
Well, besides that, he's a neighbor of mine, so that makes us bosom buddies. Okay, well, I guess we've had quite a session. I'd be prepared to go on a little longer, but you folks have tight schedules, I guess. Thanks very much for coming. Maybe we can do it again.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.